I'll stand by a little bit. You tell me what you're going to do next, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Well, I'll tell you this much. You've got the station in New Jersey you can pick up. He's got there's two stations on Four Times Square. There's a couple of stations right across the river in New Jersey. There's one in Newark. So you got a choice of places to look at it. For the most part, the stuff that comes off of Empire, I mean, I don't know if it's more than 3 degrees, 2 degrees in terms of, you know, the island when you get to be that far out, but I really don't see where you're going to get to 20 dB holes. And as far as an IFR goes, you know, display resolution bandwidth is not the greatest thing in the world. They work fine. They don't make funny stuff, but they are limited in terms of what you can see with it. But no, it's intended for looking for single carrier type things. Want to be able to have enough resolution to be able to see stuff. So it is actually a fairly decent spectrum analyzer, even though it's a little tiny window. HRIWK2J.
Okay. Thank you, Eric. Alex, you want to make another comment? N2NNU, K2LIW.
WH2YY was from before. I was trying to interject information. I kept again, put on the side here. I am 46 point miles from Empire and at a bearing of 270 degrees. That's where my town station is, 270 degrees. I'd have to point my antenna to hit Empire.
That means that the bearing from Empire to you is very close to 100 degrees. 95. You're at 95 degrees bearing. If I take the reverse bearing of 270, that is roughly, if I get it right, 85. 70. No, you said 270. That means you're exactly due east, 90 degrees. So Empire to you is very close to 90 degrees. I'm guessing Empire to Eric is closer to 85 degrees is my guess. I know Alex wanted to make another comment. N2NNU, K2LIW.
Yeah, okay. Many times the eye sees what the mind wants to see. So I wonder if Joe is seeing the correct stuff there. Is it possible that he is seeing one of those transmitters that has 10 megahertz bandwidth and is seeing only the high power transmission, the low frequency, and is not paying enough attention to look for the lowest transmission part of the about 4 megahertz away from it? So that is one possibility. We still have those transmitters in service, I think. I'm going to hook up tomorrow my analyzer and we'll see that. Anyhow, for Joe, I don't know if you heard me before. Get your cable box and put it right at the antenna. The feeder shouldn't be longer than 1 foot. And see what you're doing with that. That will be a tremendous help. That's how I put my antenna in. Think to it.
Okay, that's a possible experiment. But you said one of those channels that is 10 megacycles bandwidth in the UHF television band. Alex, run that by again. What channel do you think today is transmitting a signal for one signal channel that is 10 megacycles of bandwidth? I don't think the FCC allows anything beyond 6 megs of a channel bandwidth allocated to UHF television service. Over to you, Alex.
I'm not sure. I'm not into the high definition TV, but I know I can go to the shop and buy one of those TVs with panels. In other words, it is adaptable. It is you can look at it on analog or on digital with it. And how do they do that? It is by adding the extra 3 or 4 megahertz to the bandwidth. As who was the gentleman that said that? Anyhow. So you can buy a TV like that. That means that there is a transmitter out there for it. I said my piece. For whatever it's worth.
Okay, you can buy a television receiver made to receive a combination analog-digital, if I understand you correctly, which is a total of 10 megacycles of bandwidth. In other words, you can buy a television receiver that is set up in a manner similar to the proposal of 1995 that you were reading. Is that sort of what you're saying, Alex? Go ahead.
Yes, I think I've seen this. I was just astonished to see it. What was that shop? An electronic shop still in business. They were demonstrating an analog channel 13, and then they switched, and the screen was 16 to 4. So it had a left and right band black, so I switched to digital, and it went to channel 13 on digital, and now the band disappeared, and it had a full 16 by 4 format. So I was really surprised. That happened about a month ago.
Let me help you with that. Yeah, I'll bet you that so-called channel 13 was really 64. Over to you, Eric.
It sounds like what he's talking about, bandwidth, is not RF bandwidth, but video bandwidth, if you want to call it that, okay? For example, for Channel 13 digital, all right, the high definition runs about the statistically multiplex, and what that means is that we make good utilization of the space. 6 MHz wide channel is capable of giving you it isn't capable. It gives you a stream that's 19.393 megabits in speed, okay? So every second that goes by, there's 19,390,000 bits of data that you can do something with. And if you happen to tune to 13HD, you're going to be seeing about 14 megabits, 15 megabits of that being used to make the high definition part of the picture. Which then leaves you another 4 megabits and change to put 2 more standard definition pictures and some data and some sound and some other stuff. There's also a special kit in there called 911, which has the emergency alert system in it. The TV channel actually has a fixed bandwidth and a prescribed precise rate. That's the way the bits go out, how you want to use the bits is purely up to you, so you can have a wide bandwidth signal for a 16x9, by the way, its format is 16x9, and your regular TV format is 4x3. That 16x9 picture doesn't necessarily have to be high definition either. It could be standard definition 16x9, which is going to run at a slower bit rate, which then gives you more bandwidth to do more stuff, K2RIW, K2JUMP.
Yeah, as I see it, then there's a little bit of confusion between data rate after the signal is demodulated from its packet-like transmission technique versus what bandwidth is really transmitted in spectrum used over the air within the 6 megacycle wide allocated channel. I think some of that's the confusion, and there's also the confusion that quite possibly you can buy a receiver that is capable of receiving some of the protocols of a earlier proposal, which is not in effect right now, to my knowledge. To my knowledge right now, you can have NTSC analog television transmission or digital television transmission, and in some cases like channel 21, where there's two adjacent channels right now during this transitional period, channel 21 of the real frequency range is an analog signal, and channel 22 is a digital signal with multiple channels of information in that channel 22 spectrum coming out of that, what's really being transmitted. So we'll eventually get to the bottom of all this. Joe, did you have any further comments before we go on to Paul's going to be next? WA2RYY, interesting stuff you're doing there, Joe. K2RYW in the TechNet.
Jake, you're talking about it, Seb, with NTSC, APSB, and also QAM for cable, so those exist.
I hear you. Over to you, Joe.
Just that you said the spacing went narrower as it went higher in frequency. The spacing went higher in higher frequency, 2560 at the highest channel, and 2530 the lowest channel, as far as the spacing is concerned. And I certainly didn't see that. It's actually about 20 dB from the carrier, because the noise for the analyzer is at a minus 105, and if I could see a signal at minus 85 or so, I would go down to minus 105. If the signal was higher than that, it wouldn't quite go down to the noise floor, but I was truly seeing dips going down 20 in reference to the peak of the noise I saw at that particular channel, so it's not something I was imagining.
Yeah, I agree with you. Those are, if we had 1 or 2 dB of dip across the screen, I'd say, yeah, it's the flatness of something in the system at your QTH, but a 20 decibel dip, unless something is really bad, and by the way, 20 decibels with a 25 megacycle spacing, correction, 2.5 megacycle spacing, that's around 100 meter wavelength. So there's 300 feet of difference in path length required to do that, to get that cyclicity. And that's not likely to take place within your installation of your house. I don't think you're running 300 feet of cable, or even 150 feet of cable with some kind of a double reflection going on. I doubt it. Not impossible, but I doubt it. It would be interesting to try a quick experiment without your preamp, but you're then going to be giving up some of the threshold, and you're not going to see the depth of these notches. Let's see if Paul's available, WS2N. There was a launch a couple days ago of, I think it's the Kepler experiment, and this is a satellite that when you go to their website and read what it's going to do, it's going to keep track of the very minute changes, amplitude of the reception into a charge-coupled device array that's going to continuously be staring near the Orion Nebula. They very carefully chose a chunk of space that's outside of the galactic plane. This satellite is not in orbit around the Earth. The satellite is going to be in orbit around the Sun. Nothing is going to be affected by the Earth, and throughout the year of its measurement, it's not going to be affected by the Sun sweeping across the field of view. They chose a constellation to look at that is out of the plane of our ecliptic, and a nice place to stare at where there's some nice, healthy young stars that hopefully have a whole lot of planets going around them. And by way of looking at the change in brilliance of a star, when a planet the size of Earth passes in front of that star, that gives you partial blockage, and that goes on for something like a 15-hour period of time. The Earth passes, I think it's a 16-hour period of time. If you're out at a very long distance and you looked at our Sun, during the time the Earth passes in front of the Sun, you would see a dimming of the Sun caused by the shadow created by the Earth that would last for 16 hours. It's got a very specific signature that tells you, repeater, time. The length of time of that dimming tells you whether or not the satellite of the planet, like the Earth, is in the Goldilocks zone. It's midway between where Mercury is and where Neptune is, so that it's in a location where liquid water is possible and therefore life can likely form. You read about the way they chose and the way they set up all the electronics to do this. It's a very interesting experiment. And the smart people, I think, are starting to predict that quite a number of Earth-like planets are going to be discovered around these stars. Up till now, the searching technique looked for the wobble of the spectrum coming out of the Sun created by the planets going around that Sun, that star. And that gives you a beautiful technique for detecting the Jupiter-sized planets that are in close to the Sun, which creates a great big wobble. And the much smaller-sized planets that are at an intermediate distance, like the Earth, are much more difficult to detect with that technique. This dimming technique would be a much nicer technique for generating, for detecting Sun and Earth-like planets going around them, which just happen to be in the right plane with us, so to speak, or in the right direction. And that's going to happen something like 1% of the time. When you're looking at 100,000 stars, and only 1% of them fall into the subset that you're able to look at, that's still, if I got the numbers right, 1,000 stars to look at that fall into the category. 1,000 or 10,000? 10,000. So we got a lot of good stuff to look at here. Well, it's 1,000. 1,000 stars. So it's a reasonable cross-section to find out how much life there is out there, how many planets are capable, and also by the signature of the spectrum you get from the starlight during the time that the planet is blocking it, you will quite possibly be able to see things like atmosphere. So, maybe I've taken some of the wind out of your sail here, Paul, but that's what I read in the last couple of days when I went to that particular website for Kepler. I hope I've got the name right. WS2N, if you're there, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I have a question.
Okay, that's right. Another question in there. This is WS2N.
Go ahead, Alex.
Why would you want to spend that much money on that? Statistically, we know that there exist planets. If we want to, if we find a planet that we think that it will remain light, alive, so what? We never can make contact with them. So there must be another reason for that satellite. Did you ever think about that?
Yeah, possible. Right now, as it exists, Alex, we're doing a hell of a lot of judgment on a cross-section of one. Right now, you and I only know of one single planet in this universe that seems to harbor intelligent life. And you and I can argue about whether or not there's any intelligent life on this planet, but you know what I mean. And it would be awful nice to know, maybe the answer is 4% of all the stars out there have an Earth-like planet. And that's a strong possibility. That's a nice thing to know. For the time being, with our current technology, the distance is so great, you cannot easily communicate with them. I'm going to give you that. But to know that we're not alone, there's a certain kind of human being that gets excited by the fact that the method by which life formed on this planet is not unique. There are certain people who get very excited to find out that we are not unique, but ordinary. It's a humbling experience. And we're about to be humbled another time. I mean, we've been humbled multiple times from the old days when we used to think that the Earth was the center of the whole universe and everything revolved around us. We've been humbled a lot of times since then. I think we're about to be humbled again to find out that our planet is kind of ordinary. There's a lot of them out there capable of harboring life. And it's going to be a great goal to find a way of communicating with them or detecting their signals as we develop the technology. Just because the problem is difficult, because the distance is great, and the chances of you and I communicating with them today and having the grand QSO today is out of the question, that doesn't mean that it's not a worthwhile project. The total number of dollars coming out of your pocket in the form of taxes to support that particular project probably is $1. Alex, is that project worth $1 to you? N2NNU, K2RIW?
There'll be a flat no. That experiment cost $680 million that can be used to feed some families that don't have food to put on the table tonight, okay? Statistically, we're reaching the same conclusion. 4%, 1% doesn't really matter. We will never be able to contact them, and that's that. We are isolated. What is the reason to spend that money on it? I mean, I know we want to know, but to some extent it's all ridiculous. Back to you.
Okay, I hear you, and you've got a valid opinion. I disagree with it. And by the way, the number 4% is a number I picked out of the air. Be careful you don't quote that one as being some kind of a fact with the Kepler project. I just picked that number out of the air. And you and I have got a slight difference in philosophy. The whole idea of pure research, the fact that you're doing research at all, research and development and research, means you don't know the answer. If you knew the answer, you wouldn't be doing the research. There's a hell of a lot of research that's going on where in the beginning, no one knew the answer. And when you got the answer, it turned out to be valuable. This to you sounds like a frivolous project. I understand that. And that's one man's opinion. One Yonkers man's opinion, I might add. Up till now, I've agreed with most of what comes out of Yonkers. We'll have to check with the other Yonkers individual to find out where he stands on this one. And as long as we're taking...
Selfish.
As long as we're taking a survey here, Paul, tell us whether or not you're willing to support this project. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Let me add something, Dick.
Comment the subject?
Okay, Dick. Let me see if I have it.
Yes, you do, Paul. Go ahead.
But it's serious?
Very good. Okay. Well, you know, you got my vote to have this project and many others, Dick. That's an old-time argument, yeah, even with the space program, when they were going to launch Apollo 11 to the moon. They had all the dignitaries and representatives, and including Reverend Abernathy. He was down there, and he was always for spending money on a lot of welfare programs, put more money into employment, this and that. You know, different funds. And when he was told what these people were going to do, and they were going to go to the moon, how exciting this was when he was standing there, they said, you know, what should we do? Should we do this or not? I'm paraphrasing, but basically he said, let's push the button. You know, let's launch them. He saw what was going on. You're creating 400,000 jobs with the manned space program when it started. 400,000 people that have houses and food. And, you know, it created work. It's not a money being sent out into space and, you know, being burnt up in the sun or something. Let me talk about the Kepler. Let me drop it.
HWW, please.
Yeah, how we recognize, but we're going to get to you in a minute. Make sure you keep dropping once every minute, Paul. Paul, go ahead.
Understood. Very good. You covered it pretty good. Took off 10:47 Friday night on a Delta II rocket. And inside of no time, inside of an hour or so, this thing was 900 miles out. So this is, right away, it was not starting in low Earth orbit. It's in a heliocentric orbit, like you said. But it's lagging behind the Earth. It's an interesting orbit. You probably saw it on the Internet. It's lagging behind the Earth. Inside of 4 years, this thing will gradually get further and further away. And you got to remember, the Earth is going around at 66,000 miles per hour around the sun. So this thing is basically going 66,000 miles an hour around the sun as well, just drifting behind the Earth. To get it away from the Earth, of course, it had to go over 25,000 miles per hour to get away from the gravity of Earth very quickly. And now inside of, 4 years, it will be one-half AU. Away from the Earth, an AU astronomical unit being distance between the Earth and the Sun, 93 million miles. This thing is going to be roughly one half AU in 4 years. To keep track of it, they need the Deep Space Network. Let me drop it. Do this. So a lot of time is going to be dedicated with our antennas based around the Earth, set at 120 degrees each in the different locations, Australia, Goldstone, and Spain. You know, you've got the space network that's going to be downloading all this information. Now, a lot of people think, okay, telescope, it's pointing at the Earth and take a picture. No, you can't. It's a photometer system. Like you said, charge couple devices. Dozens of these things are planted within this roughly 1 meter diameter thing. I think I read 0.93 meter, roughly 3 feet diameter scope, looking out at these 100,000 stars. So it's quite a setup. They know it will work. It's been done before from ground based telescopes. They've looked at the dimming of different stars, and one or two cases, and maybe more, I don't know now, they have detected a dimming of the light. So they know it's going to work, and they know it's going to work great. Come back 4 years from now, and there's going to probably be hundreds, if not more, of planets that this thing, I think, will discover. By the way, all electronics, everything they checked out, everything is working fine. Let me drop it. What else could I add to that? It's not operational yet. They will go through 60 days, roughly 2 months of testing before they put the thing into actual work. And it's a scheduled for 3.5 years, and that will probably get an extension. Now, how do these things go? They'll probably double that before you know it. But the first 3.5 years, that's what it's planned for. And it'll probably go longer than that, Dick. Let's see. Pictures on the net. It's a pretty big thing if you look at it. They showed it mounted in the top of the Delta II. They had the fairings off, and you know, it looked like So, very good, Dick. Can't think of anything offhand relating to that, except like what you said, they're going to be staring at 100,000 stars all the time and checking out the dimming. What's interesting, you know, the stars that they're looking at, that means the planet is crossing in front of you. Say the planet's going around the other way, you know, from you know, not going in front of the stars. So, you know, they could extrapolate from this how many stars really do have these Earth-sized planets going around the Goldilocks zone by doing what they're doing. And also say, you know, the ones that we're looking at might also have planets, but, you know, it's not passing in front of the sun, in front of the stars. You add that up with all the other... Now, this is only within our galaxy here. We're only looking at one little part of the galaxy, and with all the billions of galaxies, wow, you know, quite a jump to what they're going to extrapolate, you know, after 3.5 years. Back to you, WS2N.
Okay. Seem to have gotten into a philosophical difference of opinion here. I'm going to go over to Howard, who's going to tell us his opinion of this. Go ahead, Howie.
Yes, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Proceed.
What I'm going to say is that whatever money has been spent on the space program has helped moving time.
Yep, the money that we've spent certainly has helped mankind, and NASA has from time to time claimed a significant fallout of their research. Puts a lot of people to work, and I'm about to ask you a question, Alex, a slightly more direct question, just to find out where the philosophical difference of opinion exists. If I wanted to be extremely severe, I could say that the Apollo program, which put 6 landings on the moon, and all we got in return for that is we got a certain number of hundreds of pounds of lunar soil, is what we brought back, and we did research with that soil, and found out something about the geology, so to speak, of the moon, the selenography of the moon. If I want to be really severe, I could say that. There are other people who feel that in the process of developing the hardware that got those astronauts to the moon, made some great strides with reference to computers and materials, ablative heat shields, things of methods of launching things into space. We got an awful lot of benefit out of it if I wanted to give it a positive spin. But if I want to give it a negative spin, I could say, oh, we got out of it some dirt. Why the heck did we do that? So if this was, let me pick a year, 1965, and the proposal to send man to the moon on the Apollo program was coming before Congress and a decision had to be made, should we do it and should we not do it? And if Alex from Yonkers was a senator and could vote on this, would you have voted for Apollo or against Apollo? And to NNU, K2LIW and the TechNet.
Okay, well, this is NNU with an honest answer. First of all, Dick, we don't know that we've been there. There are those that say that we haven't been there. And you, as well as me, you have seen that flag waving in the wind. I cannot forget that picture. Now tell me that that was an artifact or something like that, but there are those that say that we've never been there. Until we don't resolve that issue, but I think all discussions about this subject are just superfluous. Would it be worth to go to the moon? No. Only if the technology that we developed would it be used as a stepping stone to develop ballistic missiles. Then, yes, the technology that we used for putting the man on the moon has been used successfully to develop the Delta and all other rockets that now launch nuclear missiles. So, in this respect, yes. What I'm saying it is, Dick, I'm a pragmatic person. I want a return on my investment. I do not like to spend $680 million for the artificial notion that I know somewhere it's life. So what? No return on that, unless moral or whatnot. Anyhow, but I will spend trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars to define gravity, to find anti-gravity, to find a new locomotion, a system that will get rid of all the problems we have now based on gravity. I will spend trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars on fusion. I will I'm not a stupid guy, you know. I know where to put my money and to an anyone.
Okay, I've heard your opinion, and I see where you're coming from. When it comes to, did we really go to the moon? I'm a human being who has what I think is firsthand evidence. I didn't say proof, I said evidence. I set up equipment for listening to the Apollo astronauts while they were on the moon, while they were in transition from Earth to moon and from moon back to Earth. And with the receiving antenna that I set up in Farmingdale, Long Island, in roughly 1971, and you can read about this in the August 72 issue of QST magazine, I pointed that antenna into the sky at the right position where that spacecraft had to be when it is between Earth and Moon. If somebody was creating a hoax by putting something in orbit around the Earth, holding it in just the right position above my antenna, so that I could aim a 3-degree beam with antenna at the Moon, confirm the right direction of arrival of the signal, the right amplitude of signal, the right frequency of signal, the right Doppler shift as it went around the Moon, if somebody was doing that as a hoax, my goodness, they spent an awful lot of money just to fool me. And boy, they succeeded, Alex. They fooled me. From my point of view, there's very little doubt that those guys with a transmitter on 2287.5 megahertz, the Apollo command module frequency, was transmitting from that point in space on that lunar surface or in orbit around that moon, and that signal at the right amplitude, the right frequency, the right Doppler shift, at the right time of the days, and I could see the signal wink out as it went behind the moon, they fulfilled all the criteria required to say, to me, they were there. And I was a witness to it. I got direct reception of that signal, independent of broadcast media, independent of NASA's desires and whatever. So it really took place. There's no doubt in my mind about that one. And you never know where research, let me drop it. You never know where research is going to go. We could put a lot of money into fusion research, and if we could succeed, it would be a huge source of energy that would go on for tremendous amounts of time. That's the good news. Fusion energy, if we can find it, if we can solve the problem, would be a great benefit to mankind. We wouldn't have to worry about burning fossil fuels and the carbon loading of the atmosphere and the global warming. A hell of a lot of those problems would go away. That's the good news. The bad news is that fusion, the process of fusion energy conversion is an extremely difficult problem to solve in physics. And you and I can invest a whole lot of money hoping to get the benefit, and we may get nothing. That's the whole game that you play when you roll the dice and you do research. You're never absolutely sure. You hope you choose just the right projects which have the highest probability of success. You get the most bang for the dollar is what you're looking for, the most benefit to cost ratio. But some of these projects turn out to be a dry hole as far as drilling oil is concerned, if you know what I mean. See, you never know. You always have to spend a little bit of your money on what's going to sound like a crazy project, a well-chosen crazy project. Another project that exists is that we're doing a completely thorough search, we think, of all objects capable of striking the Earth that are in space. All these comets and asteroids and whatever. And it would be nice to be able to detect something out there that's going to hit us 45 years from now. It'd be nice to have 45 years of lead time in which you could do something about it. There's another whole philosophy, I've met quite a few people, let me drop, who say that if a object is going to strike the Earth and create a nuclear winter, it's something that we can't do anything about, why do you want to know? Why do you want to bother finding the object? Which is sort of a, I want to give up ahead of time attitude from my point of view. But I've met sincere people who say we shouldn't be searching for these near-Earth objects that are going to strike the Earth. We can't do anything about it. Well, I don't quite agree. I didn't say it's easy, but there's a hell of a lot more things that are unknown than known. And you got to carefully choose which ones you're going to do the research on. I think you're saying that if you were a congressman or a senator, you would only spend money on projects that directly aid mankind in the next couple of hours, couple of days, or whatever. In other words, very short periods of time is what I think you're saying. you would choose those kind of projects. And anything more long range than that, that doesn't benefit mankind almost immediately, I think you're saying you wouldn't go for it. I can understand that attitude, and some people share it with you. I probably put some words in your mouth. I'm going to send it back to you, Alex, for any comments on that. N2NNU, K2LIW.
Oh, yeah, you definitely put words in my mouth. solving the gravity issue or the fission, it's not a day or a month or a week. We have to be serious here, Dick. You know, we're talking about decades, or better than that, hundreds of years. And I'm willing to fund projects like that because they represent an immediate return of the investment the day that we have solved the problem. When I say immediate, it is when we solve the problem, not now. But me and you, we are technical people, a person, and like many other around here that listen to us, and we want to play. But we cannot play to infinitum, you know. We need to count our dollars, to put them where they can make the most difference to us. Well, we can argue about that until tomorrow, but this is my position. I will spend as much as needed, anti-gravity, fission, whatever it's required to get this country out of the hole with the energy or any other things. But to know that there is life somewhere out there, I know it. You know it. Everybody knows it. Statistically, it tells you that it happens. So why? Well, that's okay. Well, back to you, Dick.
WB2HWW, want another comment on this subject?
Yeah, you better say it at a higher power, Howie. Go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
Somewhat noisily, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to hear you very long. Go ahead.
We have the jammer out there.
Yeah, unfortunately the answer is yes. And we're going to have to establish another channel for you to be able to make your comments. The, I had a point I was going to make, and I guess we sort of made it. And that is, there's differences of opinion as to what we should do our research on. And that's the normal process. Fusion, you can put an awful lot of money into it, and you're not going to get any benefit for an awful long period of time. There are people who will tell you that fusion that takes place in the center of the sun requires, I'm going to pick numbers now, 10 million degrees Kelvin in temperature and 10 million atmospheres of pressure. And if you can bring those two conditions together, you can sustain continuous fusion and get the E equals MC squared energy out of mass to energy conversion. That's the good news. But can you, on planet Earth, create those pair of conditions to make that happen, which is one of the approaches? Tokamak tried to do that. Inertial confinement uses another technique. Can you get positive energy out of the system? It's a tough one. I much rather would like to see Mr. Obama invest his money in solar voltaics, wind, all of the renewable energy resources. I'd like this nation to be a hell of a lot more energy independent than we are right now. I'm very bothered by the fact that 60% of the petroleum we use, we import, and quite often we pay top dollar for it, and we're giving money to people who don't like us, and we're giving them the ability to use that money in ways that we don't like. We're spilling American blood in the East, Mideast, in order to maintain the stability so that we've got that supply of oil. I sure wish we didn't have to do that. We have the technology to get out from under that. And that's a beautiful way to do the research. I'm pretty sure that the current administration, let me drop, is going to be investing in improving our infrastructure, improving our energy independence, hopefully making some inroads on the cost of medical insurance and the method by which we educate our students. I'd like to believe that these are darn important things, that some investment is going to be, some significant investment is going to take place over the next 4 years. If that does take place, I'm in agreement with it. I also like the search for a small amount of money being spent on a small percentage of our national budget being spent on search for near-Earth objects, search for extraterrestrial objects, search for astronomy in general. Astronomy research is one of the purest sciences there is. I like it. And a certain percentage of the population agrees with me. A certain percentage of the population, I'm pretty sure, agrees with Alex. There's no one answer. So we're going to do some kind of a compromise. Not going to put all of our money into any one of those projects. because you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket, as they say. I think we've answered all the questions of the people who signed in with questions, but probably should go over to the mailbag, because we're always a little bit behind on that. Before I do, let me give one last listen. If anyone has a question or a comment they want to make before we go over to Mel's mailbag, give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW, and send that.
WV2HWW, this should be better. Can I make a comment, Dick, on this past subject?
Go right ahead, Howie.
Two.
And then Alex in that order. Go ahead, Howie.
When you spend money on research, you never know where it's going to go. Like, if you look at Apollo, not only did it do rockets, it gave you better computers, it gave you stuff for medicine, they were able to find them out, they came up with smaller technology for heart monitors and all kinds of stuff, because they had to solve problems for the space program, and it made our lives better. And if we're going to do research for finding life out there, we're going to need to come up with new technologies, new software. There's always a spin-off. You put people to work, you get a multiplier effect. I'd rather spend money there than just spend it on welfare. Yes, we do have to take care of people. Yes, we have to take care of our less fortunate. But we need, as a society, to put the money into an area where you're going to help people and where you're going to get a return on your investment, which is going to be a better standard of living. Back to you, Dick.
Don't forget Star Wars, too, and see if you'll take some more peace.
Okay, yeah. We're going to go to Alex and then Paul in that order. Alex, I think you want to make a further comment. Go ahead.
Also, did
you copy what I said?
Every bit of it, and it came through beautifully that time. And I agree with you. Go ahead, Alex.
Okay. First comment, then the question I have. The comment is that people that receive welfare will never be able to work programs like that. It requires that requires a different person. Anyhow, the question. I think last time when we spoke, Dick, I asked about circulators. How do they work? What are they? How can we use them? Can I get short on it? And to an enemy.
Okay. After I check with everyone else that has questions or comments, I'm going to come back and give you a small paragraph on what I know about circulators. I'm not an expert on the subject, but I have worked with them over a significant portion of 30 years. So I've developed quite a few opinions as to what they can do and what they cannot do. There was another person, I think it was Paul. You wanted to make a further comment, Paul, WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, in regard to Kepler, one other thing I wanted to bring up. By the way, I wish I had a recording of Howie. Maybe I should go to the website. That was
disconnected.
Very well done. That was very good. Very good, Howie. The Kepler, I don't know if I mentioned it before, you cannot take a picture. It's not really like a telescope. This does not replace the Hubble.
Voyager, which is now way beyond Pluto, and when it transmits that 10 watt, or it used to be a 10 watt signal, right now it's down to an 8 watt signal out of that traveling wave tube on S-band back to Earth. It's got to precisely aim its antenna at Earth, otherwise we get nothing. So each of these spacecraft have got a beautiful inertial coordinate system on board, where usually it's got the equivalent of a telescope that looks for certain stars in space in which it says, okay, that's where Cygnus is, and that's where Canopus is, and so on. It looks for particular stars and figures out its orientation in three-dimensional space, and it knows how to aim its antenna. And there are ways that the antenna itself can use so-called monopulse techniques for picking up the signal. So you're absolutely right. Each one of these spacecraft, the ones that don't go into deep, deep space, like in the case of Voyager, if that main high-gain antenna fails, I think you have very little communication with it. In the case of Kepler, it's got both a high-gain antenna and an Omni antenna. You can always talk to it by way of the Omni antenna at a much lower data rate, a lower gain antenna that doesn't have to be aimed. So if it loses its orientation, you can give it a set of commands on the Omni antenna saying that, hey, you've made this mistake, reload this program, and that fixes the mistake. I think that's part of the question you asked, Joe. WA2RYY, K2RIW.
Yeah, pretty much. I've always wondered about that because obviously if you think about it, as something gets to be 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 million miles away from Earth, or you know, 10 times that distance, the Earth itself becomes a tiny, tiny dot. If the antenna was less than a quarter of a degree, you completely miss the target by hundreds of thousands of miles.
It's not that bad, Joe. Whatever the beam width of your antenna is that's doing the transmit, if your transmitting antenna has got a 2-degree beam width, then roughly speaking, you've got to be plus or minus 1 degree aimed at the Earth. You're not trying to fill up the whole Earth with signal and precisely aim an antenna that's becoming more and more narrow in beamwidth. You can't make your antenna more narrow in beamwidth than the number of wavelengths would dictate. In other words, the amount of real estate you've dedicated to your antenna dictates the minimum beamwidth it can generate. And so that antenna, if it's a 2-degree beamwidth antenna, you've got to be accurate with it plus or minus 1 degree. Whether you're 1 mile away or 1 billion miles away, the answer is the same. You're trying to aim the peak of your particular beamwidth in the direction of the Earth's receiving antennas. And the size of the Earth, from that point of view, doesn't matter. The distance and the inverse square law of the way the signal falls off does matter. And the nice thing about the inverse square law is that it only falls off 3 decibels every time you double the distance. Voyager right now is at, let me pick a number, 2 billion miles. Maybe 10 years from now, it'll be 4 billion miles from Earth. That's only 3 dB, correction, 6 dB. That's only 6 dB more weakening of the signal. If I can slow down the data rate on the current high-gain antenna by a 4-to-1 ratio, that's what 6 dB is, I can continue to talk to it when it's at 4 billion miles 10 years from now versus the 2 billion miles it is today. I'm picking numbers out of the air to demonstrate the principle, but that's the nice thing about the inverse square law. It falls off very fast at first and very slow later. So if you've got enough margin into the system in the data rates and the amplitudes of the transmitting power and the receiver sensitivity, you can talk over some pretty big distances. In the case of talking to Voyager, I don't know the exact number, but maybe it's something like 12 hours. In other words, when you send a command to Voyager, the signal travels from the Earth to the Voyager spacecraft at the speed of light. Because Voyager is so darn far away, it takes, I'm going to pick a number, 12 hours for the signal to get there. And if you're loading a new program, you've got to say, here's the new program, put it into your memory, but do not execute it. This is the new program. It's going to take me 12 hours to send the signal to you. When you get the whole new program, send it back to me. Tell me what you heard. I want to make sure you got it right. So let's assume it takes an hour to send the program. It takes 12 hours to get there. 13 hours, that process is completed, and Voyager starts sending the signal back to you. Another 12 hours later, you get the signal back from Voyager. 13 hours, you've got it all, and now you study it bit by bit, and you say, he heard the right thing. As long as he heard it with no errors, then you send up another message and wait 12 hours and say, okay, you got it right, now go do it. Got to do that when it comes to a spacecraft out there. because if you get it wrong, you can end up with a glitch in the program where it aims the antenna in some other crazy direction, and you never talk to the darn thing again. Isn't that amazing? At the speed of light, 12 hours or something like that, to get the signal one way. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-H-U-R-I-W.
Correct.
Okay, what is the exact number of hours, Alex? That guy got it wrong. Go ahead.
It's not the hours. It's the beam dispersion. The further the satellite is, the spacecraft is, the beam is dispersing. So Earth is ending up in a very, very large field of RF. It might not be in the center, wherever or not, but it is still in the beam. So it does not remain penciled in. That is well documented with the VSATs.
Oh, okay. Let me run this one by again now, Alex. Maybe you and I have got another difference of opinion tonight. This could be the second place where you and I disagree. If my antenna in free space has a beamwidth of 2 degrees, and if that satellite is 100,000 miles from me with a 2-degree beamwidth, a million miles away from me with a 2-degree beamwidth, or a billion miles away from me with a 2-degree beamwidth, don't I have the exact same 2-degree beamwidth out of my transmitting and receiving antenna, regardless of range? And if so, doesn't the signal fall off in signal strength on what I get at Goldstone when I'm receiving Voyager, 6 dB per octave, inverse square law? Every time I double the distance, I see 6.02 decibels less signal in free space. There ain't nothing between us and that Voyager but damn empty space. There's no other matter there to scatter that signal. There's no precipitation scatter. There's no snow, rain, whatever. It's the most empty stuff there is, except for that little bit of a asteroid belt, so to speak, which is not much when it comes to the big scheme of things of sending signals that far. I've just expressed an opinion. You're allowed to differ with it. W-A-2-N-2-N-N-U, K-2-R-I-W.
My money is with Dick. It's not a laser.
Even a laser has dispersion. So what I'm saying, Dick, it is to maintain the beam width from 1,000 miles to 100 million thousand miles, you have to change your antenna. You have to change the geometry of the antenna, the specifications of the antenna, and that doesn't happen. The antenna is fixed in there. So you have a one, whatever, two, whatever degree beam width at a certain distance of the antenna, of the spacecraft, that creates the maximum field right there at this distance. After that, the beam is dispersing. You are not transmitting with a laser, and even a laser is dispersing. Back to you.
Okay. Are you telling me that at 1 million miles versus 1 billion miles, I get a different antenna pattern? Aren't I in the far field, the Fraunhofer zone? Aren't I in the far field in both cases? If I can aim the antenna foresight, let's assume I've got a 2-degree beamwidth antenna at 1 million miles. Don't I also have a 2-degree beamwidth antenna at 1 billion miles? In the case, if I want maximum signal to hit the Earth, I have to aim the bore site of that antenna, in my example, to the nearest plus or minus 1 degree. If I want it to be within the 3 dB beamwidth, or it's got a double-sided beamwidth of 2 degrees. Are you telling me the beamwidth of the transmitting antenna changes as a function of range? If you're telling me that, I'm then going to ask you, what is the definition of far field antenna pattern in free space? N2NNU, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, you asked for it. You probably didn't work in phase array antennas. Anyhow, let's take one single antenna as it is on the spacecraft. When you transmit a beam with it, you're not transmitting a pure beam. You're transmitting lobes also. Those lobes take precedence over the main beam because these are not accounted for in the antenna construction. So those lobes are creating the fringe fields that actually translate into diffraction. What I'm trying to say here, Dick, is that VSATs are just doing that. They are working with a beam, a pencil beam or a white beam, just because they know how to handle the geometry of the antennas. The far field is different from the close field. You cannot compare those two, definitely. So the far field, then we're going to have what is called a far field. That nobody bothers with it. Only the guys over the horizon radar will talk about this. But nevertheless, the space is not empty. Electrons cannot, waves cannot be transported without a medium for transportation. We do not know what that is now. This is why we're spending billions of dollars at CERN today. There is this gentleman called Higgs that thinks that there is a God particle out there that actually transports the electrons to space. But this is another story. So the beam has three functions, three patterns. Close field, far field, and very far field. In the very far field, you have the lobes taking over the main beam, because energy of it is not spent as much as the main beam. The lobes are much narrower. Back to you.
Okay, when it comes to phased arrays, yes, I can use the phased arrays in various methods to do what's called beam spoiling. I can make the pencil beam, or I can make a broadband beam. Most of the deep space aircraft, spacecraft, use the highest gain mode the antenna has. In the case of a parabolic fish antenna, you've got a feed horn that's trying to evenly smear your available transmit energy as evenly as possible across that parabolic surface, and you're trying to generate a planar wave front. That planar wave front on a good far field antenna range, or the simulation of one, gives you a certain 3 dB beam width of the main lobe. Done a good job. Those side lobes are, let me pick a number, your first major side lobes are 18 dB down, your second side lobes are 22, your third side lobes are 28 dB down. The total amount of energy in the main lobe is by far dominant. Maybe 85% of your energy is in the main lobe, and the remaining 15% of your energy is in the side lobes. That doesn't change. With a high gain mode, the highest gain mode you've got, because you want the highest possible data rate, the highest gain mode of your antenna, whether you're doing it at 1 mile, 1 million miles, or 1 billion miles, that's all you've got. That's the highest gain you've got. And you're suggesting that when I go from 1 million miles away to 1 billion miles away, you seem to be telling me that the diffraction effects of the side lobes are going to start dominating, and the main lobe, 85% of the energy, and the gain of the main lobe is changing. You're telling me the energy does not fall off 6 dB per octave as you double the distance, inverse square law. You're telling me the antenna has a brand new gain in free space. The dispersion you're talking about for very long range over the horizon radars, when you're using all kinds of crazy propagation of atmospheric and homogeneities, I'm going to give you all that. But in free space, which is the closest thing to an empty thing that you and I can imagine, I can talk about the partial pressure, let me drop a free space, and it's an extremely small number. There's very little material there. And the material that's there is very tiny in general compared to the wavelengths I'm transmitting. A unified S-band transmitter, a 4.5-inch wavelength, is not going to be interfered by very many particles in space that create blockage. When you're smearing that signal across millions of square miles, because even though you've got a 2 degree beam width, in my example, you're smearing that signal across a lot of square miles of space, and the Earth is in the middle of that bore side of that beam, and you seem to be suggesting the gain of the antenna in the far, far field is a different gain than in the far field. This seems to be what you're saying, that the effective isotropic radiated power becomes some new number. If what you just said is true, tell me how NASA is continuing to transmit signals from and to the Voyager spacecraft, which is probably, since Pluto is at 39 astronomical units, and this thing is way beyond Pluto, I'm going to pick a number. It's probably 55 astronomical units away. If what you're saying is true, what magic is NASA using to transmit signals to and from Voyager in the last month? Are you saying that that is a farce and they're not really doing it? N2NNU, K2LIW.
All right, N2NNU. First of all, I didn't change rated antenna gain changes. don't put words in my mouth. All that I'm telling you, it is the field, once parts with the antenna, starts to have its own life. At those very distances, a very high